What I'd like to do now is I'd like to talk about Epicureanism. I brought in Raphael's, the school at Athens, or the school of Athens, painting. Of course, it's not the original, which is much larger. But anyway, I love this painting because it's full of pictures of philosophers. The most famous two of them, of course, are Plato and Aristotle in the center. The reason why I took this image of Plato and stuck it on the flyer for the Timaeus Critias course is that, and it didn't come out on the flyer, but the book he's holding is the Timaeus, and it actually says Timeo on the spine. And Aristotle was holding his Ethics. Anyway, a lot of these philosophers have been identified. This is Heraclitus. And although I don't know this for sure, this Dürer-looking fellow here looks a heck of a lot like a bust of Epicurus that's in the Vatican Museum. And I think that this might be his portrait of Epicurus, or his rendition of Epicurus. So I thought I would bring this from all the way over there, here, just to point out Epicurus to you, or somebody who I think is supposed to be a representation of Epicurus. Epicurus was born late in the life of Plato, when Plato was an old man. I can give you an exact date on that, if there is one. Okay, he lived from 341 to 270 BC, and he was reputed to have authored 300 books. We don't have any complete works by him except for a couple of letters. Everything else has been lost and is preserved only in the form of fragments and reports about his views. He lived in Athens, the center of Greek philosophy at the time. Greek philosophy pretty much began on what's now the coast of present-day Turkey and the Greek cities there, but that was pre-Socratic philosophy. And with Socrates and other Athenians, the center of philosophy in Greece became Athens, and so non-Athenian philosophers would flock to Athens and live there and go to school there, and the whole city was just crawling with philosophers, actually, of various schools and sects, all battling with one another for students. Epicurus went to Athens and studied with the various philosophers, and he was very influenced by the Cynic school, and also by the Greek atomists, Democritus and Leucippus, who had been long dead, but they had students who survived. And in a way, what he does is he combines cynicism and materialism together into a systematic kind of philosophy. So we need to know what cynicism is, and we'll get to that. But Epicurus, like every post-Socratic Greek philosopher, treats moral philosophy as the primary concern. Pre-Socratic Greek philosophy is theory-centered, science-centered, cosmology-centered, whereas post-Socratic Greek philosophy is always centered around ethics. And Epicurus is no exception to this rule. The goal, which is a practical goal, is happiness for Epicurus, and he defines happiness as peace of mind. And to get to peace of mind, we first have to understand what causes peace of mind and what causes suffering. And what causes suffering for him is primarily this, illusion. False understandings of man and nature. These are the sources of human suffering. And these illusions can include myth and religion and all of opinion. And when you get down to it, just sort of the human way of looking at things. Human beings have a tendency to project their own qualities out onto the cosmos, which is known as anthropocentrism, and to interpret nature in terms of human categories. So we think that nature strives for goals because we strive for goals. But that's really superstition, nonsense. It's illusion. Okay. The path to salvation, therefore, is disillusionment. Getting rid of our illusions, and getting rid of the human point of view, if you will. This tendency to project human qualities out onto the cosmos. And the method by which we disillusion ourselves is a materialist natural science, which argues that there are no goals and ends or minds in nature, that these are just projections of our own characteristics out onto the world, but in fact the world has no minds in it besides our own. There are no gods, except in a very specialized sense. As he defines it, they're indistinguishable from idols, basically. There are no purposes that nature pursues. All of these are human characteristics, which we've mistakenly displaced out into the world. And what we need to do is come up with a purely mechanistic understanding of nature. All natural phenomena have to be explicable in terms of non-mind-like motives and processes, little pushes of material entities bumping into one another. Now, this sounds like it's getting pretty theoretical, but the underlying goal is practical. It's to liberate human beings from suffering. And therefore, Epicurus's science tends to be actually rather unscientific, okay, in this sense. He's not really ultimately concerned with studying nature. He just takes over certain views from Democritus and others to the extent that they serve his ethical purposes. And so there's a tendency to be rather dogmatic about natural philosophy and really uninterested in actually studying nature among the Epicureans. They regarded their atomism, their materialism, as merely a tool to attain peace of mind. That was the true aim. They weren't interested in nature as such, and none of them ever contributed one whit to the study of natural phenomena, even though they started out as scientific materialists, and that seems to be their starting point. Okay. Now, what is their basic cosmology? Well, this isn't in the reading, so I'll just sketch it into you. Basically, they argue that there are two things. There's atoms and void. Void is space, empty, and atoms are just little hard bits of matter that are falling through the void. And there are two kinds of motions that the atoms have. One is falling, and the other is what he calls swerving. And the reason why you have to have two motions is this. If all the atoms simply fell in straight lines through void for all eternity, they would never interact with one another, right? And nothing would ever come about. So they had to posit the idea that atoms don't just fall in parallel lines, never meeting, but they swerve from these lines and crash into one another. And what happens is a great vortex is created, a great chaos. Now what happens in this chaos is that little pockets of order emerge that can replicate themselves, that can hold out against the environing chaos and can replicate themselves over time. And that these little seeds of self-replicating order become the core of the cosmos. And there's no need for intelligence for this. You see that what the argument is that order simply happens by accident. It simply is the result of a lot of accidents over a very long period of time. Eventually, you've got enough monkeys banging on typewriters; they'll type out Hamlet. It's that kind of attitude. Chaos over a very long period of time is bound to give rise to certain accidentally orderly patterns, and over a very long time, some of these orderly patterns will have the capacity to preserve themselves. And so, order arises without design, without intelligence, out of the chaos of matter swirling around. There's no notion of design or intelligence or providence that's necessary to this. And really, this view of the origin of order out of chaos through simple random motion over a very long period of time is still around with us. This is the chief alternative to theism, right? This is the core of scientific materialism to this day. Start out with chaos, and given enough chaos over a long enough period of time, some certain orderly patterns will emerge. Darwinism takes up a basically Epicurean perspective on things. Evolution through natural selection of randomly mutated forms is an Epicurean model of nature. Now, the two greatest sources of misery for human beings, the two greatest illusions that human beings have to face, are the fear of death and the fear of powers invisible, the fear of the gods and ghosts and spirits and things like that. The fear of death stems entirely from the fear of the gods, according to Epicurus. No one would be afraid of death if they weren't afraid that they would be punished or tormented by the gods in an afterlife. Now that strikes one as utterly preposterous, because frankly it strikes me as more terrifying if death is the end, and that's that, than if I was going to hang around and have to suffer for a very long period in some other form. But Epicurus is rather glib and dogmatic about the fact that death is not fearsome in itself. It's only fearsome if you are worried about an afterlife. And he has some very glib little arguments like, well, you know, we'll never meet death because where death is, I am not. Where I am, death is not, and never the two shall meet. And, well, the fact is that one dies, and, you know, these sort of word games don't seem to really conjure away that fact, at least very effectively in my case. So anyway, religion is the basic fear that men have. We don't fear death for any other reason than fear of the gods. And therefore, we need to, in a sense, liberate ourselves from religion, which is the grand illusion, the most basic illusion of them all. And how do we get religion? Well, the Epicureans argue that religion is just bad science. Why do we have religion? Well, because people find the universe around them mysterious, and in order to explain the things of the universe, they posit mind-like forces, spirits, gods, and so forth. Well, it was basically the traditional Greek religion, you know, Zeus and the whole Olympian gang is still they're still worshipped, and, you know, people would still take their names in vain, and so forth. So it was basically the Greek gods, and the Greek gods were a rather fearsome and awful, obnoxious bunch. And so it was reasonable to fear them. You would never want your children to grow up like them. You would never want to encounter them. You'd never want to be seduced by one of them. They were just bad news all around. And Greek mythology is basically a lot of stories about all the trouble the gods cause for human beings. So what we need to do, again, is to get rid of religion. And what religion is just bad science, where people try and explain mysterious natural forces in terms of projecting human mind-like characteristics out into the world and saying, well, the reason why it rains is that somebody wants it to rain. Right? And the alternative, therefore, to religion is just good science. And the idea is that as soon as we have good science, we'll be able to understand how nature works, and we won't need to have any recourse to magic and mysticism and religion. Now, interestingly enough, though, the Epicureans did have a positive teaching about the gods, but it's really hard to figure out exactly what this means. First of all, the gods are mortal. Second, they're made out of matter. Third, they float around in the spaces between the worlds. Sounds like asteroids, frankly. Fourth, they don't care about us or even know anything about us. Fifth, the blessedness of that derives from the gods is simply basking in their presence. Okay, and really, and specifically basking in their images. Because he believed that you see things by things giving off little pictures of themselves. And really, it sounds indistinguishable. He makes the gods sound indistinguishable from idols. And it might be a kind of subtle joke, you know, in a way, you know, saying, yes, there are gods, and there are these material entities that float around, and they're pleasurable. They give blessedness by allowing us to look at them. And that's about all there is. And he also argues that the Epicurean sages are far superior to the gods. Well, I think he sort of made it all up.
Yeah.
He just sort of bunk it up. no one really took this very seriously. People wonder, you know, how he came to this conclusion. But it was not uncommon for natural philosophers before Socrates, who were basically atheists in their orientation, to come up with some kind of account of the gods to reassure people that they weren't such bad guys after all. So, if they believed that everything was fire, they'd say, well, that's what God is, it's fire. You know, God, it becomes the basic stuff of the universe. And the Epicurean gods, whatever they
are certainly not in any way fearsome. You don't have anything to fear from them unless one of them might fall onto your house, like a meteorite or something. But they become entirely irrelevant to human action. They don't care about us, don't know about us, and they don't know about anything or care about anything because they're just chunks of matter floating out there in the void. Now, what kind of moral philosophy then do the Epicureans have? Well, it's very simple, and this is where they get to the Cynics. The Cynics were a group of philosophers who looked to Socrates as their model, but so did all the other ancient schools of philosophy, basically. And they were so different because they would all emphasize different aspects of Socrates. Now, Socrates, you know, was this guy who didn't have a lot of stuff, and he went around barefoot and looked like a bum. And so the Cynics thought, well, that's how to be wise. We'll go around barefoot and look like bums. It was more than that, but basically their attitude was that what's right is right by nature. All conventions are stupid and absurd. They're just human creations. Human happiness means living in accordance with nature, and nature gives us certain desires. And unlike the Sophists, who thought that life according to nature meant getting a lot of stuff and being rich and powerful and famous, right? The Cynics said, wait a second here, none of this is natural. Right? We don't have any need for fame. We don't have any need for luxury. What do we need? Well, almost nothing, when you get right down to it. We just need enough to keep body and soul together. And everything else over and above that is just a source of anxiety and tension, a waste of time. And so what did they do? Well, they spent their time trying to simplify their lives as much as possible. So, for instance, these guys didn't have really many ties to other human beings. They were rather nasty characters, generally. They thought that being wise was precisely paring down all your desires to the absolute minimum, okay, and dispensing with anything unnecessary. They would occasionally gather together to bitch and complain about the unenlightened nature of everyone else, but they didn't. They were primarily solitary, and Diogenes is the most famous Cynic. And Diogenes gave up his house, and because he didn't need it, he decided that all he needed was something to keep the rain off. So he had a cloak, but that wasn't enough. So he also had a rain barrel. He turned a rain barrel on its side and lived in this big barrel or tub, things vary, in the marketplace in Athens. And he didn't need a he didn't need a job. He discovered because he could simply steal and beg. So he stopped working. Yeah, exactly. They could all be philosophers, so he should have more respect for these people. Some of them could be. He had a bowl and a cup, and he realized he didn't need these. He saw a child cupping its hands to drink water and realized he didn't need this cup and threw it away. And when he saw some other child ladling lentils out of a pot, piece of bread, a crust of bread, he got rid of his bowl, too, and thanked them for teaching him valuable lessons. And he pared his life down to the absolute minimum. And what did he do with his time? Well, he sort of went around getting in conversations with people and, getting them angry. He would chase people with a stick if he saw them praying to statues of the gods and things like that, because he thought this was all nonsense. And he was a somewhat disreputable, colorful, local figure in Athens. Alexander the Great went to see him when he came into town and asked Diogenes, is there anything I can do for you? And he said, yeah, you can stand aside, you're blocking my light. Oh, he would also go around during the day with a lighted lantern. Now, why would anyone need a lantern, especially in the day? Well, one needed it as a prop because he said he was going around searching for an honest man. Couldn't find any. He was a theatrical ploy. He always made a great ploy of seeking the truth. He was invited to Plato's house one time, and Plato, who was well-to-do and had good taste, had the expensive carpets on the floors and things like that, and Diogenes tracked mud all over his carpets and said, thus do I trample upon the pride of Plato. And Plato responded, well, There's a lot of pride in your humility, Diogenes. So anyway, this is the Cynics. But what Epicurus took from the Cynics is basically this attitude that what's right is right by nature. And so what do we do? We follow nature. And how do we follow nature? Well, we look to the most uncorrupted people. And who are the most uncorrupted people? Why, the children. They're wiser than we are. And what do children do? They pursue pleasures and avoid pains. And since the minds haven't been corrupted by education and convention, we know that they are acting in accordance with nature. So we follow nature by pursuing pleasures and avoiding pains. Now, there are several different kinds of pleasures. Okay, there are pleasures that are natural and necessary, pleasures that are natural and unnecessary, and pleasures that are neither natural nor necessary. So, what would be an example of a natural and a necessary pleasure? A natural and necessary pleasure.
Eating,
right? Exactly. What's a natural but unnecessary pleasure?
Sex.
Well, they didn't think it was necessary. So they tended to abstain. And what's a pleasure that's neither natural nor necessary? Sex with animals or something. I mean, they're driving automobiles, things like that, listening to classical music on CD. None of these are natural or necessary pleasures. And so what they did basically is this. They made a list of all the pleasures and categorized them in terms of the natural and necessary. The natural and unnecessary, and the neither natural nor necessary. But that just can't work, right? There can't be a necessary but not natural pleasure. Necessity has to be derived from nature, right? And if there's no nature in it, then there's going to be no necessity to it. That's the sense. Now, not everything natural is necessary, but everything necessary is natural. That's the sense. So they took an inventory of their pleasures, and they immediately eliminated all non-natural, non-necessary pleasures. So all the luxuries go out. Fame, fortune, things like that. Then they try to get rid of the natural and unnecessary pleasures as much as possible. Okay. And finally, they went about satisfying the natural and necessary pleasures. Okay. The goal is pleasure again. They're hedonists. They understood pleasure as peace of mind, ultimately. Not as the surging of the passions, but as their quietude, right? Quieted passions is what pleasure is. These people tended to be what we would call nervous, sensitive types. There's some people who find that they can only be happy if they're tense, right? Things that quicken their hearts and scare them and things like that. Strenuous sorts of pleasures, tense sorts of pleasures. These people had no patience for that. They liked to relax. They were the New Age music crowd, not the romantics. They would listen to George Winston, but find Mahler to be deeply disturbing. They would never get bored with Vivaldi, no matter how many concertos they listened to that sounded all the same. It's this quiet, relaxing sort of music. One of the sources of worry comes from, the only things we worry about are things in the present and in the future. The past is done, and you shouldn't worry about that. It's crazy. Right? You might regret it, but you don't worry about it. You don't have any apprehensiveness that something is going to change in the past. Right? Now, it is kind of odd how certain things can change in the past. For instance, I watched an absolutely dreadful movie a few weeks ago called Day of the Locust. It was a John Schlesinger film, and I thought it would be good because most of his films are, but it was absolute garbage. And there was this one character in it, played by Donald Sutherland. And it wasn't supposed to be funny, but when he said his name, it was, because his name was Homer Simpson. Okay? And the meaning of it had been changed, after the fact, by the Simpsons. Okay, so, but for the most part, what's past is past. But anyway, it is possible at least to change the meaning of things that have already happened, but you can't change the fact that his name was Homer Simpson as much as you might regret that it was now. But anyway, we worry about the present and the future. There's no point in worrying about the past. you worry about contingencies, and there are no contingencies in the past, but only contingencies are now and in the future. That's the sense of it. So we have to secure our safety in the present and the future. We can't master nature, they argue, so we have to lessen our needs and give fewer hostages to bad luck. This is very much like the Stoics. We have to master ourselves rather than the world, in other words. The only real and secure pleasures are those that cannot be taken away from us. Right? So anything that we enjoy in the present or anything that we enjoy by contemplating in the future are things that we shouldn't base our pleasures on. So one thing we need to do is especially avoid making any of our pleasures depend on future things. Too much emphasis on the future is alienating and a source of anxiety, right? Don't worry about the future. Anything in the future you shouldn't worry too much about. You shouldn't make your happiness depend on plans that you have for the future. Things that are happening now are fairly secure, but they can always be spoiled. And the most secure pleasures are things that have already happened in the past, okay? So what does this mean? Well, it means that, really, the greatest form of happiness to a human being is simply recollecting past pleasures. That's the most secure form of happiness. Recollecting things that have already happened that are good. Because nothing can mess those up. Okay? They can't be taken away from you. Going out and trying to gain new things, oh, that's sweaty and tense and uncertain. But if you've had a few nice things happen to you in the past, you can sit back and sort of recollect, reminisce, enjoy them, and you have a kind of undimmed happiness through the recollection of past pleasures in solitude, quiet. Whenever you have something good happen, fix it in your mind, because then you want to be able to revisit it. The ideal stage of life is not youth, but age, because the older you get, the more nice things you can think back on and remember, and the less future you've got to worry about.
Oh, sure.
It's deeply true. Their asceticism, their desire to give up unnatural and unnecessary pleasures, does turn them into elitists of a sort, because very few people can live as disciplined a sort of life as they. So they were a very small and rather elitist group. And what they tended to do is live together in little communities, little ashram-type communities, where they could all monitor one another and encourage one another in giving up things. And Epicurus had a little house with a garden outside of Athens. And he and his friends lived there, and they were quite happy, apparently. They had an emphasis on a retired life, obviously. You know, getting into politics was not the right thing to do. Epicurus wrote books. And also, they were very well organized as a school. So even though there were very few people there, they were extremely good at going out and recruiting, you know, for the small band. And so they passed things on. And they were highly organized, and the school lasted for 700 years or so, until Christianity sort of absorbed everything in the Roman world. It was organized like a cult. There were founding documents that were adhered to rigorously. If you disagreed with anything, they chased you away. They managed to recruit enough people to keep this going for a very long period of time. So it was sort of a cult. And it appealed to some very influential and well-to-do people who would give them enough money to live lives of leisure. They didn't care. They'd had no teachings about social duties or anything like that. They were totally retired. They didn't believe that the gods cared for the world, and they didn't believe that wise people should care for anybody else either. And so they had a tendency to be totally uninterested in helping others unless they were like-minded. They were entirely uninvolved with anybody but themselves and like-minded people. They denigrated marriage and the family, because there are pleasures associated with that, but not necessary ones. Natural pleasures, but not necessary ones. And so they didn't reproduce, they just recruited. Okay. But as the Catholic Church proves, you can keep organizations that don't reproduce alive very long periods of time by recruitment. They reduced sex to just pleasure, right? It was just a matter of pleasure. It didn't have any larger spiritual or psychological meaning to them. And that was one of the reasons why they found it easier to give up, because it wasn't that meaningful. Because they had a tendency to not think in terms of the future, but only in terms of the present, and focus on merely the physical aspects of things. Sexuality just became a matter of, the stimulation of the body's surfaces, in other words. And it was not something that was relaxing, it's discomforting, it's messy, right? And it causes elevated heart rates and things like this. And so they just thought that this was, messy and icky and not relaxing in the least. And so their sexual lives tended towards fantasy, voyeurism, and recollections of past affairs, where you didn't have to think about the messy or sticky or, strenuous aspects of it. They were parasitic on the fact that there were other people out there who were wandering around full of illusions, right? They had a very cavalier and unsentimental attitude about things like abortion, suicide, euthanasia, fratricide. Life is about pleasure, even in the most ascetic sense, and they didn't regard life as having any intrinsic dignity or worth to it. Their political philosophy was rather simple. They didn't believe that there were any naturally good or naturally just institutions, but that politics was merely a matter of creating conventions that would restrain people's bad behavior and create peace and security. So they were the first social contract theorists. Basically, Epicureanism is enormously influential in modern philosophy. Early modern philosophers like Hobbes and Spinoza were modern Epicureans in a very deep sense. There are aspects of Epicureanism in Vico and Montesquieu and Rousseau. And there are different dimensions of modern Epicureanism, but still, they were enormously influential in modern philosophy. The idea, again, is very simple. The argument's very simple. We should follow nature. How do you follow nature? By looking at people who are relatively natural, uncorrupted, uneducated. Those are the children. What do the children do? Well, the wisdom of the children is that they pursue pleasure and avoid pain. We should pursue pleasure and avoid pain. But they had a tendency to think in terms of very relaxed, quiet pleasures, right? Not strenuous pleasures, not dirty or messy pleasures. And so they had an emphasis on enjoying just basic things that you could easily do. They had a view that basically it was very easy to satisfy your natural and necessary pleasures. It's harder to satisfy all the others because it's more work. And so they thought that life would be pretty easy and relaxing if they just simplified everything. And they had a tendency to avoid sex, avoid reproduction, and to live in the past, basically. And many people looked upon this as just, slavish. The people at the time, they looked on these people as slavish because they were so concerned with avoiding work, strenuousness. They were terrified of risks, and they were excessively concerned with the preservation of their bodies. Right? They were, in a sense, very attached to what was natural and necessary. They were very, very concerned with self-preservation. And they had no sense of honor. Any issue of honor and things like that, they regarded as purely a matter of convention. They were not patriotic. They never fought duels. They could exist under virtually any conditions, and were happy to as long as they were just left alone. They had, apparently, rules of treating their own well. And they were always accused of not having very stable friendships for the simple reason that they regarded friendship as a matter of pleasure. Right, and the fact is that my friends give me considerable pleasure, but not all the time. And one of the ways that they argued against this was that you learn to take pleasure in the sheer presence of people, even if it's not gratifying. You like things because they're familiar. But they didn't have a very, I suppose, elevated or ethical view of friendship as something that might entail commitments to others that would involve pain. They certainly didn't do that. This is why they avoided love and things like this. It's full of pain. The Epicureans were very, very consistent in their understanding of the good life as pleasure according to nature. And the arguments that they give are fairly simple arguments. And what they manage to do, at least to my mind, is point out just how much of life isn't about pleasure. You know, when you start paring things down, you realize that most of what we consider constitutive of a good human life has nothing to do with pleasure. These people had no real interest in culture or art. These things were neither natural nor necessary. Right? They thought that there was very little that ultimately differentiated us from animals. You got right down to it. And in fact, there was this kind of jealousy towards animals because animals just naturally pursued pleasure and avoided pain and didn't have any sort of illusions that prevented them from doing this. Right? Whereas human beings seem to be the only species that had what they called illusions that led them to not pursue pleasure and avoid pain. And so in a way, on the Epicurean account, we're very ill-suited for this world. The animals are better suited. Now remember what Kant would say to that. He'd say, well, the fact that we seem so ill-suited for the life of animals means that there's probably a higher end that we need to pursue. Namely, the life of culture. And the Epicureans had no interest in that. And what they tried to do was they tried to reduce everything political and social down to the bare-bones utilitarian protection of life. And if you look at someone like Hobbes, what's the purpose of politics or political life? Self-preservation, that's all there is to it. Fear of death leads us to politics out of self-preservation. Which is actually a revolutionary change in the way people view politics. Because, as Aristotle puts it in his ethics, or in his politics, actually, the city, the polis, exists not for mere life, but for the good life, which is something over and above mere life. If you want mere life, you live in a little farm somewhere. And that's what the Epicureans said. They said, okay, we'll go and live in a little farm somewhere. And that's what they did. They were against anything urbane and cultured, and for the very simple. So anyway, that pretty much sums these guys up. The longest extant work of Epicurean philosophy is a poem by Lucretius called On the Nature of Things. That's a 1st century BC Roman version of Epicureanism. It's very interesting. When the Epicureans moved to Italy, they started writing poetry. And they wrote some fabulous poetry. Horace was an Epicurean, for instance. Virgil was an Epicurean. All the great Roman poets of the so-called Silver Age, or the Augustan Age, were Epicureans. And Philodemus was a 1st century BC Epicurean philosopher. And he was also a poet. And we have... his library was discovered in the 18th century. They found his library had been buried by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. He had lived in a vast villa near Herculaneum. And this villa was the home of one Calpurnius Piso, who was a Roman big shot and a patron of the arts. And I believe it's the very same Piso who is represented in the I. Claudius series as a henchman of Tiberius. And Philodemus lived in his villa, and when he died, his library was preserved there, and when Vesuvius blew up, decades and decades after his death, everything was buried. And they found this library filled with all of these carbonized papyrus scrolls. And they never really had a good technology for, unrolling these incredibly brittle things, and they were burned, so it was really impossible to read them. But they've been able slowly to unroll these things and read them using new techniques, and new editions of his works are being published now, which is very interesting. It'll take 100 years, probably, to adequately unroll and decipher and publish all this stuff. But But anyway, it's a great archaeological find. And these things have been sitting around for more than 200 years, waiting for people to figure out what to do with them. They found fragments of Lucretius' poem there, too. But who knows what else will come to light. And also in Egypt, they found some papyrus scrolls of works by Philodemus, much better preserved in the dry sand. So more of his stuff is coming out. But all the Roman Epicureans were great poets, which is really interesting.